of the day, United States versus States. Ms. Katz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Rachel Katz, and I represent Defendant Appellant Charles States. I'm well aware that the panel is familiar with this case, so I will not go into great detail in regards to the facts. However, I will go into detail where relevant on the two arguments that I wish to focus on today. The first argument I wish to address is the issue of prejudicial joinder. It is our position that the district court erred in failing to sever the two distinct groups of offenses, mainly the counts arising from the day of Mr. State's arrest, from the group of counts relating to the RICO and drug conspiracy charges. The district court's failure to sever these offenses resulted in actual prejudice, thereby denying Mr. States his right to a fair trial. As such, we respect that Mr. State's conviction be vacated and remanded for a new trial. We are aware that there's a...
I was just going to say, obviously most or a lot of the discussion about this part of your argument focuses on whether it's really properly before us at this point, because we all agree that before the trial, the person who was then representing Mr. States was talking about joinder of defendants, and later on we move over to this joint, really I think of these two packages getting grouped together. And as you know, a Rule 12 motion, Rule 12 requires a motion under Rule 14 to sever charges to be made before the trial. It really just wasn't. So at the very best, aren't we dealing with something that's been forfeited?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I was going to address, that this was a forfeited issue that should be addressed under a plain error standard.
And I don't see how you can possibly surmount that, actually, given the fact that in the conspiracy part of the case, the evidence was going to come in on both sides of this case. I don't know which side looks worse, actually, but I don't see it.
Well, it's not necessarily true that all of the evidence would come in had they been tried separately. The attempt murder charge isn't necessarily related to a drug conspiracy charge or a RICO charge. And if they were to ask that the gun be admitted into evidence based on the assumption that to show a propensity to use a gun in furtherance of the crime, then the court would have to determine whether or not it was prejudicial.
But there was plenty of gun. Well, first of all, of course, there was a jury instruction that told the jury to keep these things straight. And we have, whether you think it's warranted or not, it's a matter of law, we have a lot of confidence in these jury instructions. Secondly, in the drug part of the case, it's my understanding that a great deal of evidence about money and guns and kidnapping and all sorts of things that the Carmen Brothers crew was up to came in, even though he was the only one who went to trial. But these were all conspirators and the evidence came in.
Correct. There were two co-conspirators who testified at trial. And their evidence, I guess, or their testimony was corroborated solely based on the fact that his voluntary admission of guilt was brought in.
Right. But I'm just thinking, so the jury's sitting there, it's hearing about all these guns and so on the conspiracy side. What's one more gun going to do to it? Is this really plain error?
Well, that all goes to whether or not, sitting in the reasonable mind of the jury, whether or not they can keep that evidence of one more gun being, and whether it's used to shoot a federal officer, whether that would influence in any way their decision to determine that he did use a gun in furtherance of the drug conspiracy.
Well, didn't he make a statement, I think, that went into evidence about after he got arrested that he thought some drug dealers might be kicking in his door because he'd had some trouble with drug dealers, which relates to what he was doing with the drug dealers and the conspiracy, doesn't it?
And arguably you are correct. He indicated that he didn't know that they were federal officers, and he had believed that they were, in fact, drug dealers.
Yeah,
now,
because of what he did in the conspiracy, he had good reason to think that some drug dealers might be taking his story.
Correct. But, I know I can't pick and choose which part of the magistrate's recommendation that I approve of, but obviously they didn't find his testimony credible. So are we to assume then that he really did believe they were drug... it becomes an issue of whether or not how one takes his testimony, and arguably.
But there was a lot of evidence as to both tracks here.
Of course. But when, as in here, there is where offenses are brought together based on the having being of similar nature, there's a heightened risk of undue prejudice. And
but wouldn't you agree that on plain error review, I think this is what Judge Tender was implying, when the evidence is very strong on both counts of conviction, we are less likely to find plain error.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't terribly weak on either side, looking at the record.
Well, as to several of the witnesses who testified, they were co-defendants or victims of the kidnappings or the extortion, and they all had criminal backgrounds, and their testimony was subject to some sort of scrutiny as to whether or not they were actually telling the truth, whether they had a motive to fabricate. So I think there was the if things were tried separately, that there is that issue.
I think there is that issue, and had the motion timely been made, I don't know what the judge would have done, but in fact, it's a very common feature of these, particularly these big drug dealer cases, where there's a constellation of offenses that go around the arrangement, and we usually, to go back to my point about jury instructions, trust the jury to keep it all straight. Now, I realize they convicted Mr. States, though, on virtually everything, right?
On everything, yes. And I know that when they acquit on some and convict on others, that is evidence that they were able to separate the evidence. And
we don't have that
here. We do not have that here. And it's based on the record and the amount of attorneys that were involved in this case, it seems more or less that this was a forfeited error, that it was overlooked, it was a mere oversight, that, I mean, the attorney who originally filed the motion at the time, there were six defendants, I believe, going to trial. So, and then there's also the issue of whether or not they were filing their motions under Rule 8B when there's a joint trial, joinder of offenses and joinder of defendants.
Ms. Katz, last year in our Acox decision, U.S. versus Acox, we said that when a motion is subject to waiver under Rule 12, defendant's not even entitled to plain error review unless you can establish good cause.
And I believe that the good cause
is what? Too many attorneys?
Well, what happened was is that prior to trial, Mr. Cutrone filed a motion for relief from prejudicial joinder of defendants and for severance from the trial of the co-defendants. 15 months after the motion was filed, when Mr. States was now being represented by Mr. Thomas, the district court entered an order denying Mr. States' motion, stating that granting the motion would result in the same evidence being produced at 3 to 5 trials. By the time that Mr. States went to trial, Mr. Steingold was representing him and had about 3 months to prepare for trial. And I don't know whether it was a mistaken belief on behalf of Mr. Steingold, because in his post-trial motion, he does indicate that he is renewing a motion that was originally filed. However, the original motion was for misjoinder of defendants and then prejudicial joinder of defendants, as opposed to misjoinder of offenses or relief from prejudicial joinder.
Now, was it Mr. States who kept asking for new lawyers, or were the lawyers? What caused that?
From what I can glean from the record, Mr. Thomas's motion he filed was by agreement with Mr. States. They were both asking that he be granted leave to withdraw. The record is not clear as to why the other attorneys withdrew or whether or not it was Mr. States who did not want them to represent him. Or if, I know at one point he had indicated wanting to represent himself,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Steingold was appointed as standby counsel.
Let me jump over to your argument about when does the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attach. The problem that I have with your position is it seems to equate a criminal complaint to an information or an indictment. And do you have any case that has done that?
Your Honor, I have not prepared to address that issue right now. I'd be more than happy to address it in a supplemental brief.
It's in your brief. But
no, and of course. And
okay. What was the other question that you wanted to talk about then, the Miranda?
No, the issue of his sentence.
Oh, his sentence. Okay. just to clarify, in your brief, you say after all was said and done, he wound up with the level 42, category 1, 360 to life?
Correct.
Yes.
And was sentenced to life plus 57 years.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The issue with respect to Mr. Seitz's sentencing is very simple, and I'll be very brief. The issue is whether it was reasonable, meaning that they conformed with the 3553A factors. But before a reviewing court can actually determine whether or not the judge abuses discretion, the court has to make sure that the district court actually exercised that discretion, meaning that there's a record that indicates he considered all of the relevant 3553A factors. And this court has said in Cunningham that simple statement that he considered all relevant factors as this will not always suffice. The judge must actually wade into the application of the relevant statutory factors.
But what else could he have said? He says he has the letter from the defendant's mother, and he says, and it's indeed a depressing description of a difficult and hard life, and I take that into consideration. I mean, how is he supposed to elaborate on that point further?
It's not that exact point that I find difficult. It's that in relation to his age and his youth, and indicating that at this point in time the defendant at this point in time is not capable of living in a society and abiding by the fundamental and basic rules that are necessary to keep our society from generating into a state of chaos. The issue I have is that, and that we have, is that he's 29 years old at the time that he's being sentenced. The conduct for which he's charged is in a relatively short period of time. The kidnapping RICO conspiracy charges were July and August of 2001. Then the arrest, which caused the other charges, was 2002. Now, to say that a man with a family who is 29 years old has a history of drug abuse and suicide can never, in the rest of his life, conform with society's demands and norms is a bit, I believe, needs more explanation. To say that this was definitely the nature and circumstances of the offense are heinous and they're not to be taken lightly. But when sentencing someone to life plus 57 years when they're 29 years old is basically saying, I don't believe that there's any hope that you can rejoin society. And I think that it is not enough simply to say that this short period of time indicates that he will never be able to enter into society. And I think that the record, the district court judge spends a page before he pronounces his sentence. And while under these circumstances, it doesn't seem to be enough to justify such a harsh sentence. It's not the low end of the guideline range. The guideline range is 360 to life. It's life plus the statutory mandatory 57 years. And I don't believe that the record is clear that the district court judge exercised his discretion in a reasonable way, that it was a reasonable exercise of discretion. And for that, I think it needs to be remanded for resentencing.
I reserve a little time, Ms.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Ms. Katz.
May it please the Court, Bowling Hatzel, present on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start by addressing the second argument, the sentencing that was imposed on the defendant. It's noteworthy that the judge specified and noted that he presided over the trial. As such, he was well aware of the offense conduct of the defendant, offense conduct that included a barrage of bullets aimed at federal agent. It's offense conduct that involved kidnapping of drug dealers, extorting a kilogram of cocaine, extorting money, the defendant standing by with a weapon, repeatedly threatening to kill the individuals that he kidnapped. And this is the conduct that the judge was well acquainted with. This is the conduct that, when weighing the 3553 factors, which the judge did, the judge found more important.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, I don't detect any particular attack on the mandatory 57 years for the consecutive. So just doing some, you know, off the top of my head math, even if the judge had gone down to a 240-month sentence, for the rest of it, that winds up as 77 years, and if he was almost 30, he'd be 100. Well, I mean, obviously, if he behaved himself perfectly, he wouldn't be 107, but he would be pretty much spending the rest of his life in prison anyway, right?
That's true, Judge. The impact of the sentencing guidelines would have been substantial even had the judge gone with a lower sentence.
Was there a statutory mandatory minimum for the drug counts?
I'm afraid I don't have that answer off the top of my head, yeah, Judge. I'm sure there were, based on the amounts. I'm certain that there were, but I don't have that at my fingertips. Essentially, the defendant offered one fundamental reason for a lower-end sentence, and that was his difficult upbringing. And as Your Honor noted, that was specifically addressed by the judge. But the judge also considered all of the other 3553 factors as significant.
Well, but his youth, I mean, that's what Ms. Katz was also mentioning here, in the relatively short period of time in which he managed to rack up quite a record. What about his youth? 29 is not that old.
Well, initially, Judge, it should be noted that the youth was only presented really in passing, just noting his, quote, relative youth at the time of sentencing, and he was pushing 30. But beyond that, there was no specific argument advanced for why his age, being nearly 30, would be relevant.
But it's a big deal to throw somebody away, basically, which is what we do when we put them in.
It is a big deal, and it's one that the judge considered. The judge noted that, in his opinion, the defendant was not able to conform to the norms of society. It would not be able to do so moving forward. So certainly the 3553 requirement that the judge look to protect society from defendant's future conduct, criminal conduct, it was addressed. And it is a lengthy sentence, but again, given the scope of the defendant's offense conduct, it certainly is reasonable when you view it in its entirety. Again, Judge, all of the 3553 requirements were met, and the judge really laid them out, noting that the defendant needed the mental health and substance abuse treatment, which notes, providing the defendant with other correctional treatment. As I noted, protecting the public from crimes by the defendant, the need for the sentence to reflect the seriousness of the offense. These were all considered by the judge. Now, turning to the waiver argument, it should be noted, as we argued in our brief, that this was waiver. It was not simply forfeiture.
You know, I have problems with your arguments about strategic choices being made here not to pursue an 8A misjoinder claim. It's hard for me to see that those are really strategic choices.
Judge, as we noted, there are stresses and concerns for any defendant, and we noted the hope that there could be some verdict splitting. Essentially, Judge, this is a defendant who, by going to trial on all counts, jeopardy attached to all counts at that time. As Judge Wood noted, the strength for both sets of charges of the evidence was overwhelming. Maybe the defendant rationally believed, I have a better chance of convincing one jury that I'm not guilty as opposed to two separate juries. Maybe the defendant, as you noted, Judge, said, well, my strongest defense against the officer's charge, the attempted murder, is that I can relate all this evidence about the drug dealers and how they like to kidnap each other, and that's my best defense against these charges. So I certainly think there were reasonable, rational explanations for going to trial.
But that's inferential. You're not – waiver requires something much stronger than that, and, you know, not just kind of guessing. And forfeiture is what picks up the kind of arguments that you're making. I think waiver is, you know, intentional relinquishment kind of concept.
We're certainly going to be in a position.
We don't have any clue that there's. We have this sort of array of lawyers coming back and forth, and 14 months elapsing before the judge does anything.
We do have something here, Judge, that's different than most cases, and that is in the district court's decision with respect to not only the defendant's misjoinder of defendant's claim, but also to a co-defendant's claim with respect to these charges. The judge specifically added a footnote, noting that Mr. States failed to raise this argument, and therefore it is waived as to him. You cannot put a defendant on more clear notice of the waiver than the judge did in this case.
Well, I'm going to say, this is apropos of probably not very much, but as Judge Flom pointed out, this is an area in which the word waiver has a special meaning, because usually waiver means you're done, there's no jurisdiction to do it, whereas if you look at Rule 12, it's really waiver unless there's good cause, which makes it much more like what the Supreme Court is now calling forfeiture to the point that if you happen to be somebody who follows what the Advisory Committee on Criminal Rules does, you will see that they are thinking of rewriting Rule 12 so that this problem goes away. But at the moment, under our law, there's a very specialized meaning of waiver in this kind of situation, which translates into a forfeiture sort of standard of review.
Yes, Judge. First of all, with respect to the good cause, it's my understanding that that would, should have been presented to the district court. When Mr. Steingold realized this was not addressed, he should have made a motion to the court to show the cause, which was not done, for failing to bring it to the district court's attention. Secondly, and although we argue that waiver does apply here, even looking at it under a forfeiture analysis, the defendant's claims fail. As was noted by each of your honors, there were reasons to have these counts joined. There was evidentiary overlap. Specifically, not only did, during his post-arrest statement, not only did the defendant discuss his belief that individuals coming through the door may have been drug dealers, but most noteworthy is this was an interview that dealt with both sets of charges. And therefore, the evidence would have been admissible had the counts been severed in both trials. The same evidence, the same witnesses, the same Miranda waiver.
It seems like maybe some overlap.
Well, certainly some overlap. And beyond that, Judge, there are additional facts that show the overlap. Specifically, one particular item I would like to highlight is the newspaper in the defendant's apartment. There was much discussion that when, prior to the officers coming to the door, the defendant showed his girlfriend a newspaper article where it discussed that he was wanted for these offenses, thereby showing his knowledge of the warrant outstanding. So again, the facts of the RICO and the kidnapping would have been relevant because it showed his knowledge of the warrant, his knowledge that he was wanted for these offenses, and really would be relevant to show his response to law enforcement.
You know, there's a kind of a touching assumption, though, in your argument, which is that drug dealers bent on vengeance would never try to get somebody to open the door by yelling word police. I'm not really sure if that's right.
That's probably fair to say, Judge. But in general, though, Judge, there was overlap in the evidence. Unless there are further questions, I would close by asking this court to affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Axel. Ms. Katz.
Just a few points. Specifically with the overlap of the evidence and the witnesses, there wasn't a great overlap. There were 20 witnesses at trial, the majority of them of which would have testified in just in terms of the attempted murder of federal officers. There were maybe 7 different officers who testified, 2 detectives who interviewed him, 3 bystanders at the apartment complex, a ballistics expert. All of those would have gone, would not have been able to testify or wouldn't have needed to testify at the RICO conspiracy drug charge group. And in terms of Mr. Steingold filing a motion to show cause at that point, it's clear from his motion for a new trial that he thinks he is renewing a motion that was previously filed. He does not believe that it is being raised for the first time on in post-trial motion. Thank you.
That's thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.